Hello, listeners. This is Valeria Rusnak, and I welcome you all to the 11th episode of the Rejected Pre-Med podcast. I often start episodes by saying that rejection is often redirection, and it is not innately negative. In fact, it can lead us to personal and professional growth, and it should be viewed as an opportunity. In today's episode, we have a very special guest, Dr. Michael Unger. Dr. Michael Unger is the founder and director of the Resilience Research Center at Dalhousie University, where he holds the Canada Research Chair in Child, Family, and Community Resilience. In 2022, Dr. Unger was ranked the number one social work scholar in the world in recognition of his groundbreaking work as a family therapist and resilience researcher. His work has transformed the global understanding of human adaptation in stressful environments and organizational processes, with a particular focus on the resilience of marginalized children and families, as well as adult populations facing mental health challenges at home and in the workplace. Dr. Unger regularly consults with international NGOs like the Red Cross and Save the Children, government agencies in over a dozen countries, and educational institutions at all levels. He has authored over 250 peer-reviewed articles, book chapters, and 17 books. His blog, Nurturing Resilience, can be found on Psychology Today's website. There is so much more I could say about Dr. Unger's incredible accomplishments, but in the interest of time, I will just leave it right here. So thank you so much, Michael, for taking the time to join us on the podcast. I'm thrilled to have you here, and I'm excited to dive into your insights on rejections and resilience. I know our listeners will gain a lot from your perspective and expertise. So first, can you please share with me, how do you feel about doing today's episode?
So when someone invites you onto a podcast in which you're going to talk about rejection and failure and disasters in your life, I mean, that's just like an uplifting day, I guess. I don't know. it's a funny way of segueing into a conversation.
Yeah.
Resilience. And it's kind of a great hook, because I kind of, when you approached me about this, I thought, yeah, that's such a common experience, and one that we hide from and really don't understand that we are more resilient because of that four-letter F word, fail. You know, if we try to embrace and use that as part of the learning and growth cycle.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. And before we dive into more your expertise on resilience, I do want to ask how you even got to be doing what you're doing today. Tell us briefly about your background. How are you led to become a family therapist and a social scientist specializing in resilience? How does that come to be?
Oh boy. Like many folks, you know, the seven career principle, I think I was moving more into journalism and then international development work and then child and youth work, and bit by bit became a clinician, a therapist, and certified over, you know, really decades in my 20s and my 30s. And then kind of reluctantly became a university professor when I realized I was doing some teaching and clinical work and research already in my position. I was working with juvenile delinquents in custody facilities. And, you know, it's funny how life just kind of propels you forward. But I think my interest in resilience really came out of this, partially my clinical work, that I was encountering young people who were doing better than I would have expected, given their past traumas and everything else. But I think maybe I was just sensitive to reading those situations based a little bit on my own personal experience, something I've written a little bit about in I Still Love You, which is one of the books I put out. And basically, I emancipated my family very young, about 16 years old, and left. And I was one of those, in a way, very fortunate. I was able to put myself into a university setting. Universities didn't cost very much. I was able to, you know, sort of get myself into a really good space, both, and I worked a lot of hours. I was often working 20, 25 hours a week while I was going through university. But all of that together, I think, made me a little bit sensitive to the idea that, you know, things might look very difficult, but there are ways that many people survive and even sometimes thrive out of those circumstances. And that got me sort of curious about why I was seeing that same pattern in many of the young people with whom I was working clinically, who were coming out of environments far more damaging, far more dangerous, far more risky, far more traumatizing than my own. And that's kind of where this all started from.
Yeah, no, it's interesting how it's something that started off in your childhood that led you kind of by a current in a way of what you're doing right now. A lot of the things, like my passion for this work, stems from the experiences I went through and helping me in a way figure out certain things. And even me starting this podcast, I'm not saying this is directly related or similar to your experience, but even when I started this podcast about rejections and resilience, I first tried to help myself figure out how do I overcome this rejection that I've experienced from medical school and how do I build resilience? So that's kind of how it started. And in a way, I find that it's interesting how people are led into this kind of work. So thanks for sharing that.
You're welcome. And what intrigued me a little bit looking, you know, when I was reflecting back, I realized that, you know, I hadn't really done it alone, even though it felt like maybe at the time like I was, but there was certainly, you know, a grade 10 teacher that inspired me that, you know, really helped me to get through a tough time and really inspired me that he saw great potential in what I could do. And in fact, very memorably, and probably in the theme of here, I had just recently arrived at that high school. And I remember I wrote my very first essay for him. And he was quite an inspirational character. And he ran the school play and he did all kinds of other stuff. He's very engaged with the students, a wonderful fellow. And Steve Weinberg is his name. I remember I wrote this wonderful paper for, you know, some assignment, and he gave me an A on it. And then he kind of leans over my desk when he gave me back the paper and he just said, you know, I just want to let you know, that's the last A you're going to get in my class. And I was like shocked. I said, and then, but what an absolute compliment. He said, you know, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not grading you this. And I don't mean this boastfully. Please don't take that this way. But it was just the theme of somebody seeing me and seeing that I had some potential, more potential maybe than I was hearing in other parts of my life. And this fellow basically leaned over and said, look, you know, I'm not going to grade you the same way as any of the other students because I know that you can do exceptionally much better. I mean, and again, not boastfully, but just that when someone sees you, whether it's because you're a great skier or jokester or you know, you're really good at, you know, cooking or something about you that shines through and the world notices it, that's something that you can really Velcro yourself to for a lot of years. I mean, that's just that idea that, okay, someone's believing in me. And so he's saying, giving you another A here because I think he eventually gave me an A. I think eventually he
deserved it probably.
Whatever. But I mean, that sense of that, you know, you're going to, you know, I'm expecting you to step up. And isn't that a wonderful gift to give? What a wonderful thing to give anyone for what they're showing the world at a particular moment of potential vulnerability. And that point in time, it was a little bit pretty chaotic in my life.
You never know how someone's words can impact, like even similar to your story. I remember I still have my grade 12 yearbook. And sometimes like when nostalgia hits, I look back at it. And I think a lot of those words that teachers have said to me have stayed in my head like since then. And it's been almost 10 years. So, and I think it will stay because it's very important to have people in your life who will support you and who will mentor you and who will guide you without probably them even knowing about it, but just people who there support you and help you be on the path that will make you happy and peace and bring you fulfillment too. So that's wonderful. That's great that you had a teacher like that. What subject was the teacher teaching?
It was English, language arts, English, I guess. In grade 10 at a high school in Montreal. And later on, I went into, you know, do some theater. He was the director of the school play. And I stayed in touch for many, many years after I graduated high school, all through my university years. And he was always sort of a little bit of a touchstone, not just for me, but for quite a few other young people. And, you know, in a really nice, safe way of, you know, inspiring the best. I think he, you know, he had a real knack for seeing young people that might just need that extra push or that extra little bit of support that might be floundering a little bit. So nice when you have those kinds of people in your life.
Yeah, exactly. I had a chemistry AP teacher who scared the crap out of me for the first month I had him as a teacher. But then he became one of those figures for me as well. So yeah, I resonate with what you say a lot.
Yeah.
This kind of ties into the next question I was going to ask you. In your work, you emphasize that resilience is not just about an individual's mindset, but it's deeply tied to the environment and possibly the people or the systems that surround you or the systems you're in. Can you explain what you mean by that? And how would you define resilience in a broader sense? I know it's a loaded question, so start where you like.
It's been an interesting journey understanding this concept of resilience, because of course, I, like all of us, we started back in the late 80s or early 90s reading developmental psychologists like Michael Rutter, Norman Garmezzi, who had really talked about resilience as a process, but still focused on the individual. It really started from a more individual psychological perspective. And then, of course, there was, you know, potentially family, maybe school, that would somehow influence, but it was still largely about attributions and locus of control and internal cognitive processes. And I'm a little bit more of a social scientist than a psychological scientist. And so as I was reading that literature, I kept sort of bumping into that question of, well, what about the environment? What about the context? What about other factors? And so as I was doing my own doctoral work, I began to sort of ponder those questions. The field of resilience was very intriguing. Felt like a large umbrella under which a lot of people doing a lot of different kind of thinking were finding themselves. There was also at the same time other folks doing work on community resilience and mental resilience. And there's a whole group out of Stockholm that was thinking about social ecological resilience, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a kind of a buzz about it. And then about 2002, when I started at Dalhousie University in Halifax, I was very fortunate to get some initial research funding in which I took an idea of this resilience. And I said, I really want to find out if culture and context matter, because this is where my thinking was. That somebody has to pay more attention, not just to the primary attachments in a child's life, but there's got to be something more about your culture and your difference. And you got to remember, as I mentioned, I wanted to be like a foreign correspondent, a journalist or something. So I was already in that sort of that social justice league or side of things a little bit for many years. And so what I did was I was able to talk and build a network of folks in like 14 communities, 11 countries, 5 continents. And what we did was we went and found all the children who were exceptionally stressed, like those who were in adverse circumstances, whether because of a physical disability in India, incredible poverty in South Africa, or maybe working children in Cambodia. We just went around the world finding different samples, different groups of children under stress, and then saying, but there's a group here that are doing well. Why? Mm-hmm. And it was obviously we began to ask these kids, and through a long process of research and whatever, there was a story being told about this interaction between the environment and the individual. It was about social policies and economic conditions and meeting positive thinking and, you know, not catastrophizing your thinking. And it was like there was this kind of ping pong game going between the individual and the environment. Now, at that time, I didn't have it well theorized. It was patterns and themes that were emerging, processes that I was seeing. But more and more, the more I studied it, the more studies we did collectively around the world with partners, the more these patterns emerged into some cohesive models that began to think about the multiple systems, that the systems around us affect us. And so I boiled it down to a very simple thought. When I wrote a book called Change Your World, what I used eventually settled on was this idea of us needing to be rugged, having the rugged individual qualities, mindfulness, self-regulation, problem-solving, decision-making, good nutrition, a variety of other biological and psychological. Mm-hmm. And also the environment around us. I really think that the reason I was sensitive to that was because somewhat it was informed a little bit by my own sort of earlier perspective. That's, you know, it's one thing to have a positive attitude. It's another thing to have a positive attitude and a friend or a mentor or a job. Suddenly the story got a lot richer. And then these young people all around the world were sort of basically telling us that the protective factors that mattered to them weren't just inside of themselves, but we're swimming around them in the community as well. And that, you know, these, when their community valued them. And one of the better stories I heard was when we were doing this research with some children in Ghana, and we were asking them, just like we were all over the world, saying, well, what is it that makes a child resilient, doing better than expected here? And what we kept hearing about was children said, or adults too, said, a child is more resilient when they know that they have to contribute to their family and look after their parents when they're elderly. This idea of when the child is seen by their community as competent and caring and contributing to the welfare of the whole family, that is a sign of resilience. That is the quality that is looked for in a resilient child. Now, I came back to Canada thinking, well, you never hear that definition of resilience, right? You never hear, oh, you're resilient because you're about to support your parents. And to, so I ran that by my own children at the time who were, you know, how old would they have been? 12, 14, whatever. And I ran that by my own kids. I said, hey, resilient kids are the ones that support their parents into their old age. What do you think about that? And I got the eye roll. Like, that ain't going to happen, Dad. You know?
Oh, yeah. The culture differences. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of funny because, of course, there is no expectation in my world that our children do that. I mean, that's not a cultural norm where I sit. It is, it can be found in Canada, but that's not a cultural norm, the space that I sit. So it was kind of a funny little episode, but it was that teachable moment for me of, right, this is not going to be the same everywhere. There's going to be a kernel. And the kernel of the truth there was a child needs to be valued by their community. They need to be seen. Well, coming back to my experience with my grade 10 English teacher, you need to be seen by others as competent and a contributing member. And that doesn't change across cultures. But what exactly contributing means, there's a vast range of definitions across many different spaces.
So when you say the environment impacts our resilience, you mean the fact that we need to be seen as valued and competent and something we have something to contribute to society. Is there anything else to that, or is this just like the basic definition that you would give?
I would say that that's only one part of it, actually. Example sort of flows, but what we see in our environment also makes us feel safe. It makes us feel like we belong. It makes us feel like we can derive meaning from our activities. It gives us routines, and out of routine gives us an opportunity to feel like the world's predictable. So the environment actually plays a number of different functions. It prevents a wide array of social connections, not just intimacy, but also that we just feel connected, whether it's to a bus driver or the person who serves us our morning coffee at the same coffee shop where we go every morning. There's, you know, I think these environments are sort of complex, nested systems themselves that provide us with all kinds of opportunities. And, you know, usually what I say is, you know, what you select is going to be culturally meaningful, relevant to you and what you need. So, you know, for some children, that's going to be, you know, it's great that I have access to post-secondary education. It's going to be my path. It's going to be the way I'm going to know myself is valued. And for other children, it's going to be, no, it's a, that is not what's going to be valued. It's just going to be employment in a paying job or, you know, whatever the situation is. So I think there's always a, you know, I think of resilience as a process of navigation towards resources that you need and negotiation to find the resources that you need in ways that, that you experience as meaningful. So I know sometimes the definition you sometimes hear, and it's one I really hate, and I almost hate repeating it, but that's the idea of you bouncing back from adversity. But it's kind of a repulsive idea, because if you're bouncing back, then you're implying that's all on your individual shoulders. You are responsible for your bounce. The fact that the next person over bounces back and they have a trampoline doesn't seem to make any difference, right? So generally speaking, most scientists in my space are not talking about bouncing back anymore. Now we're talking about resources and processes of growth and all that kind of stuff, because, you know, there's a, I will literally sometimes have people in audiences that I present to stand up and say, oh, could you please stop calling me resilient? And I empathize, because of course, to do that means that they have to overcome adversity. Versus if I could actually think about resilience as, you know, changing the circumstances around them so that they have the opportunities to become their best selves. In other words, they don't have to change. They don't have to be resilient anymore, because the world around them is more resilient, is providing them for the opportunities they need to do well. And you know, my, you know, the story after story, that seems to be what I'm hearing and learning from the world around me.
And I got a question, and it's not in our script or guide, but just something that came up. We did talk about how resilience, the understanding and definition of resilience can vary across cultures, what we mean by contributing member to society or community. I wonder, how does the fact that now we have the social media distractions, how does that impact the definition of resilience? And does that impact our ability to be resilient? Because sometimes we have these comparisons. Sometimes we feel more like a failure because we start comparing ourselves to others on social media. So there's all these factors that weren't at play in the 90s or the 80s. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on it.
Yeah. Well, Valeria, I really like where you're going with that, because once you enter and you add a new technology like social media to this, these mechanisms, what we're seeing, of course, is, people are being somewhat disadvantaged in terms of their resilience or being made more vulnerable as a consequence of their time online. The social desirability, the constant social comparisons, the fear of missing out, all of these phenomena are sort of creating psychological and social stress, social anxiety, seems to be undermining our ability to feel good about ourselves, have self-esteem, feel connected, and all these other things that we know are the foundation stones for getting through a crisis, i.e. being more resilient, showing more resilience. That said, I mean, I'll be a little bit of, my own contrarian here for a second. We're also hearing that when people are more actively engaged online, finding communities that they are with like-minded individuals that maybe, especially if you're feeling marginalized, if you're a new country and you're not settling in, or you're finding linguistically you're isolated or socially, all of those folks are experiencing this social media universe is potentially very helpful, avoiding the perils of acculturation, avoiding the perils of exclusion, breaking down what is an epidemic in our country around loneliness and social isolation. Right. So it's not all bad, but there is, of course, that distinction. And most of the researchers on social media seem to be pointing in this direction, saying you have to be active online, not just passively. So if you're just passively watching TikTok videos, that's not great. But if you're actively posting and creating content and engaging in conversations, even gaming with a small community, it seems like, this is not my research, this is other folks, that the impact of those activities is potentially benign or even mildly positive as well. So I guess it's like any tool. How do we use it? And are we getting control of it to our benefit versus feeling like we're a victim of it? And from a resilience point of view, I think what we're trying to figure out is how can we actually tame this many-headed beast called the internet and social media to our psychological and social advantage.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing is that it all depends eventually how we use social media and how we perceive it, maybe, and the narrative we build around it. Can help us either contribute to it and feel like we're building a community, or we'll either scroll through it passively, compare ourselves to others, because that's how we perceive that it's just a tool that I can use to see people that are better than me, or it's just somewhere where you can feel like you can find belonging by finding people you feel comfortable with and at home with. But yeah, thanks for that. I know it's a bit of a put you on the spot there with that question, but it's just something that popped into my head as you were describing how definitions of resilience can vary across cultures. But I thought maybe they can vary across time too, especially with these new technologies. But leading up to the next question, what are some, given all that you've said, social media, not social media, our environments, our systems, what are some practical ways people can build resilience, even accounting for the fact that it's not all individual, and maybe they're adjusting they can adjust their surroundings with some simple steps, or not so simple steps, or taking individual action. What are some ways that people can build resilience, especially when they're like feeling very vulnerable? They may be facing repeated rejections, and they're struggling to move forward. Where do they start? What should they do?
Wow. Well, I think, I mean, I'd love to sort of switch the table on that and ask yourself how you got through those multiple rejections, or how that, you got here. So obviously something happened, but if I was to just give you a cheat sheet of some of the things that I keep hearing about, there's no sort of hierarchy to this. These are just ideas. And what we do see is a connection between different factors. So it doesn't really matter which you choose, as long as you start somewhere. That's kind of the message behind things like social prescribing, right? Doctors now are saying, you know, rather than giving a pill for depression or loneliness or social anxiety, they're saying basically, look, go to a movie with a friend or find someone, go, you know, call up a family member, do something that will extend your social network and give you a real legitimate contact with somebody else. And that's probably going to be as impactful as taking a pill to modulate your mood in essence. But there's other things. I mean, you know, social relationships are really important, and it doesn't have to be, you know, that intimate other that you found. You swipe left or right. I know I have five kids in their 20s. They're all swiping. Anyways, I know you swipe. But you know, it's like, look, it doesn't have to be that kind of relationship, but it can also be the networks of people that we know. And, you know, if we have a dog and we're at the dog park and we're getting known as, oh, you're the owner of the golden, you know, golden doodle sort of thing or something. It's all those informal networks that embed us and make us feel like we belong somewhere. So relationships are one sort of part of the, you know, the chair, if you will. It's going to be stable. But then there's others, like, you know, I always start with people and routines. Do you have a basic routine to your day? If you're feeling all stressed and out of it and worried and catastrophizing, and you're thinking, start with, what is my routine? And because there's something about, if I repeat the same routine each day, my world becomes more predictable and I become a little more optimistic. Because the world is, okay, I got through yesterday, I went to that coffee shop, I got to bed at night, everything, you know, can I, if I repeat, then I'm more likely to finish the day, or believe I'm going to finish the day in exactly the same space. Gratitude jars, like, you know, having a little moment in time where I actually say, notice, and, you know, I take a little pebble that I've gathered and put it into my little gratitude jar. But it's the act of remembering something that happened positively during the day. But that cognitive trick only works if I have actually had something positive in my day. So right. Something about, you know, did I do something? There's, you know, Adam Grant's idea of being a giver and a taker, you know, that we want to give to somebody else. Maybe I actually cooked something and brought it to the office, or I made an effort to offer to my neighbor to, you know, walk their dog. I see that there's some problem that they've had or something. So, you know, again and again, whether it's routines or contributing, finding meaningful opportunities to show, to use our talents, to use those skills, maybe in our workplace, to let other people know that we have something to contribute. There's, you know, other things, just making sure we feel safe, looking after your sleep hygiene. Is the bed comfortable? Is the room dark enough for you? Is it, you know, is it quiet? Are you getting enough hours of sleep so you can rejuvenate? Are you taking your vacations if you're working, or are you trying to make sure you're re-energizing? If you have young children, you're not going to do any of this, by the way. but that's part of, you know, that's a cycle of life. You know, you might go on to exhaustion or let the tank really empty for, you know, maybe because a parent is very ill or because a child is, you know, very young. Or you're going to school and you're training and you're in an internship that's just exhausting you, like many medical students experience. So all of these things, but the point is that there's an element of self-care, but there's also an element of finding those environments around you, whether it's through routine, housing, community, friends, patterns to your day that allow you some space to re-energize and take away the stress. So, you know, I'm always thinking, sometimes people say, you know, here's a very simple example. People say, oh, I'm having trouble with money and I'm running out, my credit card is all maxed out, I've got all these problems and And you know, part of it is, okay, let's send you off for a cognitive therapy to focus on how you can be more self-regulated, restrain yourself and all that stuff. Yeah, that's good. You want to do it. But the very first thing you do is you cut up the credit card.
Right.
Or you get a money card. You get a cash credit card as opposed to a billable credit card. There's other forms of credit cards you can get that would avoid the problem. In other words, when it's maxed out, it's done, sort of thing. Or you avoid going to places where you are likely to spend money. You change. The other one, of course, is we change our peer group. This is the classic one with dieting, not that dieting should be done or whatever, but you know, if you are, you know, becoming very health conscious and stuff, I say, you know, it's very interesting. People will do the cognitive thing. Oh, I'm going to focus. I'm going to change my mindset. I'm going to think of myself as healthy. I'm going to have beautiful pictures of myself. I'm going to put up messages, every, you know, whatever. Actually, one of the tricks is think about your peer group and who's in your peer group. Because if you change your peer group, sometimes it's a lot easier to stick to a different food regime. You know, on Friday, you know, I always say on Friday nights, the regime was that all of us go have beer and wings and at the local pub. Nothing wrong, by the way, with beer and wings. But if that's your routine, it's going to be very difficult for you to go and order a you know, a low-cal soda and a salad at the pub.
Right.
The disgusting place to do it, but maybe you're going to do it. You're not going to do that for more than 1 week, I guarantee you. But if you change your peer group and suddenly that group is out on Friday nights going to play pickleball, which seems to be all the rage now, including with my family members. If pickleball, you know, if that's your Friday evening, then your peer group is going to kind of lead you into a different physical regime. And they're probably not going to go for beer and wings after, or they maybe they will, but it probably won't have quite the same, you know, impact or whatever. So my point is that, you know, when people stop thinking about this as a purely individual pursuit, begin to think about this as a collective, or my environment can change and that can spur me to be my best self. Generally speaking, the changes we try and make are more sustainable.
Yeah, well said. No follow-up questions to that. Definitely the routine one stuck with me. I'm struggling sometimes to find a feel of routine, so I'll be personally working on that. But thank you for all the ways that people can build resilience. And yeah, keep in mind, everyone, that it's not individual. Resilience is as much or even more about the people and the systems and the groups that you surround yourself with. That's definitely one of the bigger takeaways for me from our conversation today. And since we're kind of getting to the topic of rejections, and I asked all of the guests to share this if they're comfortable. So Michael, have you ever faced rejection in your professional, personal life or personal life? How did you navigate it? And maybe it has helped you in some way. So yeah. Share what you feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah. For sure. First of all, in my professional life now, I mean, I'm a university professor and I publish a lot of stuff. Anyone's ever tried to publish a book, you know, I think we all have a bit of a narcissistic wound that occurs when everyone, you know, you get your rejection. You know, you get your rejection letters, and you just have to have a really thick skin to continue to pursue grants and publications and books. You know, that's just the nature of it. And indeed, I present a lot too in front of audiences, and there's always somebody who's, you know, sort of trashing you in the, it's just the nature of, you know, whatever, you know, the way it is. And maybe a little bit today, there's a little more brutality in some of the way people talk to each other. But, you know, if you think about it on a more personal level, then yeah, I can even say, like, you know, there's probably I had, you know, obviously a rejection from my parents. It wasn't a very close relationship. They kind of drifted away, not just from me, but from my siblings as well, and their grandchildren. So it was a very sort of, you know, sort of, there was a lot of that kind of rejection, which I think I compensated for by finding a very great partner in my life. You know, she's amazing, and it's kind of like you know, you find other people who are your family as station. But you know, I do think in my life too, I mean, because I was quite young, I had to take a lot of risks, I had to put myself out there. A big part of that has been embracing failure and learning from it, and willing to go forward. In fact, you know, I was thinking there was one episode that really did stand out in a very funny way. I was sort of off my game. I just had an experience being out west. I came back to Montreal. I was trying to figure out what to do next in my career and life. I was in my early 20s, and things were, you know, really scraping the bottom financially. I didn't have a lot of money, didn't have a lot of resources, and kind of out of sorts. And I thought I was going to stay at West and have a job, and didn't quite work out. Whatever. I'm back in Montreal, and I eventually applied to an organization for that had a youth shelter. Thought I was, and it was one of the first steps actually for me moving from more community work into youth work and that type of thing. So I applied for this job, and I still remember the executive director asking me questions about how to handle certain situations and what would be your repertoire and what would you think your strengths are, and all those kinds of questions. And I blew it. Oh my gosh, it was Valeria, it was an awful interview. I mean, I answered questions, I muddled answers, I obviously answered the wrong thing. I could just tell I was off my game. Incoherent. I don't know,
I think
whatever.
we've all had those interviews. I had one like that recently, I think.
I walked out of the interview. I'll try again, do something else, or figure out another path here, whatever. Anyways, 2 days later, the executive director calls me. I say, oh, it's going to be a rejection. He says, yeah, we'd like to offer you the job. And my very first sentence out to him, back to him, honestly, I'm not lying about this. I said to him, his name is Michael. Michael, why are you offering me this job? I knew that interview. And he kind of chuckled a little bit, and he said, honestly, you want the honest answer? You were the best of the worst.
Best of the worst.
I don't know.
That's a compliment.
And what an epitaph, right? You were the best of the worst, or sort of thing, something. Anyways, but I just happened to be in the right place at the wrong time. I guess I was breathing and didn't look like I was going to do any harm. I was actually quite good at the job, and I just, it was a moment. We have all been in the wrong space for a particular interview, and it worked out. And it was actually, for me, a catalyst to a whole career path that really has affected me for, 35, 40 years. But I still remember Michael's telling me that you were the best of the worst. But I mean, I know that's not quite the rejection. It was, in a sense, a backhanded rejection. But sometimes, we have to acknowledge that we just aren't in the right, we aren't in the right space to succeed. Now, this I did have, one has to integrate those lessons of failure and see it as a feedback loop in terms of a learning cycle that pushes you forward to then think, what can I do better? What do I need in terms of skill development, social supports, or friends or colleagues? What do I need in terms of, if I'm open to learning, I'm more likely to succeed. And I think when we're shut down to the learning, we're more likely to just continue the failure. So there's definitely an element of saying, thankfully I failed and gave me more information about what I had to do next.
No, thank you for sharing that. And the fact that you said sometimes we're just not in the space, the headspace to succeed. I definitely felt that with med school and the MCAT writing and all of the path that I went through. It's just, I was trying really hard. And I have a pretty good GPA. It's not the best. It's not like 4.0, but it's good. So it's like, I shouldn't have a problem with the MCAT, but I just did. I wrote that thing 3 times and I studied for it like crazy. I did everything I thought I could within my financial budget, and just nothing. And then on top of it, I dislocated my kneecap, which is fine, by the way, now, but I dislocated my kneecap before my final attempt. I'm like, what is this? Just what the odds are just not. But it has given me so much learning and it has led me to starting this podcast. And it serves me much better to think that in a way, I'm glad I had that experience because it has taught me so much and it has taught me to focus in a way, it's kind of forced me to focus on more self-care and actually pursue what more like more peace. And because if even if I got into medical school, I think I would have burned out by so much expectation. And I was so sensitive to it all, and I was such a perfectionist, and I needed to just get away from that. And I think all those experiences helped me get away from that kind of thinking. And I'm still working on it, but I'm in so much better space than I used to be. And I don't even want to, like, not that there's anything wrong with medicine, but I don't think I want to pursue it, at least in the near future. So it's funny the way life just happens sometimes. And but yeah, so thank you for sharing it. And it still kind of counts as a rejection because you thought that the like you had the worst interview. Maybe in a way, call it self-rejection. And best of the worst is a backhanded compliment, but you know, you did the job just great. And I think you were just fine. And yeah, but thank you. So I'm just reflecting what I was thinking as you were sharing your story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, if we're sort of open to it. What I worry about sometimes is the, and this is the focus of the latest book, The Limits of Resilience. What I would worry about is sometimes we are trying to be too resilient. In fact, you know, it's really, I got to say, it was kind of funny being invited onto this podcast because I had an experience of, once working with a fellow who applied to medical school 3 times and each time was rejected by multiple medical schools.
Mm-hmm.
And his approach was, well, he's just going to keep applying until he gets in. Mm-hmm. And there was no real refinement of his skill set. He didn't go back and, you know, repeat courses. He didn't kind of like it was kind of like, okay, I'm going to be resilient and I'm just going to keep trying and trying and trying. And, you know, and I kind of wanted to explain that is not resilience. That is toxic positivity, I think it goes by these days, because it's not that you shouldn't keep trying, but if 3 times you're really flat out rejected, then maybe it is time to, even if you are trying a 4th or 5th time, maybe you have to start opening other doors. And I remember asking him, why do you want to be a doctor? And the answer was really about money and prestige, not about care and service. Mm-hmm. And so if your criteria is you want money and prestige, then why have you equated that with a medical profession? No. Versus maybe thinking about other ways. And even if you're in them, so, you know, if his answer was obviously pointing to any number of different uses, he could go into, you know, business or management. He could go in, you know, I don't know, whatever else he could go into. But also if he was really into the care and service side of it and the medical profession wasn't, being a doctor per se, wasn't quite accessible. What's remarkable is all the other allied professionals, whether it's nursing, physiotherapy, OT, ophthalmology, pharmacy, you know, I can just keep going on and on and on. You know, that there are all these other ways of entering a medical facility as a competent, caring contributor to your community without it only being as a physician. There are so many different ways that you could be interested in science and pure or applied science. And I do sometimes wonder if enough people are thinking about all the other pathways that kind of intellect could go. And maybe we don't want all the type A, you know, academic, I describe myself a little bit. But, you know, becoming, you know, medical docs, maybe we want some of them to fail more. Like we don't do a personality test on them. We don't say, are you going to actually be happy in this rather routinized environment, career? You know, one sometimes has to think that maybe in the failure to get into medical school, there are certain personalities that are actually more likely to be quite happy with another choice.
Yeah. And speaking as a former pre-med, I think I used to kind of idealize and romanticize the profession. And because certain cultures are like, when my parents heard that I wanted to be a doctor, they didn't even question it. And although it's an honorable medical profession, but like you said, there's so many different fields, so many different jobs out there, we just don't bother sometimes looking at because we're just so fixated on that. That's what happened to me. And recently I watched this video of I don't know her name, but she's on Instagram. She's has a degree for medical doctor and she started working as a doctor. But then she quit and she pursued the job of an actor. She's now an actress and she's pursuing that and she's much more happy in that. And I think what she was saying is that sometimes when you're considering profession of a physician, sometimes you, like you said, some people will be really happy with that. They have that personality type that they'll be really happy with how the job is, all the hours, what the routine is like. But sometimes you're going into that, you get accepted and you just don't fit into that mold that they're they built for the medical professionals. And then it's really, and then you're in that, you're like, okay, I put so much money into this. I'm now a doctor and I don't feel fulfilled. I don't feel like this is for me. And I feel like potentially, I can't speak for sure because I'm not in their shoes, but I'm confident that there are people who do have that realization. There are people who switch and then they talk about like what you were saying, is that there are other professions, and sometimes medical profession is just not something that fits everyone's personality, and it's worth looking into other things as well. And I'm so happy that rejection happened for me. So that's my story of rejection is redirection, because I started looking at entrepreneurship. I started looking at management. I started looking at mental health startups, something I would never consider because I was just so fixated on this medicine bubble. And finally, my rejection forced me to look a bit outwards and see what else is out there. And I realized, oh, there are more things that fit more my talents, my current talents, my strength, my values, and maybe I should pursue those. And who knows, maybe in the future I'll come back to medicine, but maybe I won't. I'm not as tied to it as I used to be.
I think for me, it's becoming less, more obvious as I do the research in this area too, that people mm-hmm. are puzzle pieces. We don't have that one, you know, when you do a puzzle, yes. each piece has to fit into one slot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's a sort of determinism in that, right? That, you know, oh, well, you know, your parents will say, you're going to become a doctor, you're going to become an engineer, you're going to whatever.
Yeah.
But I think of us much more like tangrams, which is a collection of shapes that can form a variety of different shapes. So you can put them into a square, you can put them into a rectangle, you can make a little bird out of them or whatever. Like if you take the, you know, a bunch of different types of squares, triangles, rectangles, you know, and you can push them into different shapes, they sort of snap together. And I remember in one of our studies, there was this fellow in his late 20s who had an interesting story. He had originally wanted to be an actor. Just coming back to that idea. He'd actually wanted to be an actor, and he went to school and studied acting and, you know, left university and was one of those struggling actors working in a, you know, the restaurants and stuff. And, you know, was trying to get a few little gigs in television and whatever. And it was going to be pretty mediocre for him. Mm-hmm. Anyways, he, you know, he came back and he had a life partner, and it was, you know, getting pretty serious, and they were thinking about a child. And anyways, he ended up to earn money. He started working with his brother, in a company that his brother had that was making literally cement foundations for houses. And it was, the economy was reasonably good and there was a lot of work. And so he's kind of doing that and earning better money than he would at a, you know, wherever else he could work. Mm-hmm. And but he was still trying to become an actor. Anyways, eventually his brother decided to get out of the business and wanted to get rid of the business, sell it off or whatever. And this young fellow that he was just in his late 20s at the time, he said, he looked at the situation and kind of made a very strategic decision. He said, you know, this acting thing, I don't think it's working. It's kind of a bit of a failure, but I kind of would like a steady paycheck. I don't think I'm built for this, you know, endless insecurity. I would like a steady paycheck. I'd like to just have a routine to my day, to do something outdoors, whatever. And so what he did was he actually took over the foundation building company, this cement foundations, like putting in new houses. And it gave him financial stability. It gave him, you know, his management skills a little bit, whatever. And this is the best part. He is now part of a community theater troupe. Still goes away to workshops on theater. And his hobby, his passion, his persona is still kind of an actor. But but he realized that he had more dimensions to himself than that one job would necessarily fulfill. And I'm always amazed when people, you know, if you think about our resilience as a collection of factors, we are not just, I want to be on stage. Though for some people, that is the only thing that they want. But for others, it's also about connections and friends and being in a community. You're feeling, you love to read, you love to explore ideas, you know, whatever it is about that you love to do. But if it's only about being on that stage in front of the audience and getting those accolades and that sort of narcissistic boost, then you might become kind of a bit disappointed unless you really are the best of the best. Sometimes in our, you know, in our failure to achieve something, we might actually have a more satisfying life overall.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this wasn't my question, but I think we're kind of answering it right now, is that the book, The Limits of Resilience. And like you said, like, how do you know when to quit? Are we being too resilient? And is it too much when you just put your whole identity around, like you said, being on stage, maybe, like, unless you're the best of the best, which, let's face it, more than 8 billion people on the planet. We can't all be the best of the best. So but depending on your personality and what, maybe there's more aspects to your life than just your career or your relationship. So it's nice to not put all your eggs in one basket, pretty much. I was wondering, do you have other points to say about how resilience is not just about bouncing back, but it's also about our ability to self-disrupt and embrace occasional much needed failure? I really like that point, and it really aligns with the mission of this podcast, because it is actually just about showing how failure can help us become better in a way we can personally grow, professionally grow. So if you like, you can add more things. Like, can you please like elaborate on this in more detail? Or how do you think this idea even just applies to rejection per se? Although we did already talk about it, but I was wondering what else you can say about this.
Yeah, I do find it's an interesting perspective on resilience. Once one gets out of the idea that, you know, endless striving is necessarily resilience, because sometimes, you know, as the title of the book suggests, it's, you know, in the limits of resilience, it's sometimes better to persevere, sometimes better to change, and sometimes to quit. And all of those strategies are aspects of resilience. In fact, there are, you know, these, you know, famous stories of when a business like Kodak just didn't know, they were persevering with film, even though they had the technology for digital long before anyone else, but they just didn't know when to change. Because they were so economically successful with film. And of course, they were just wiped out within a couple of years. They went from, you know, major Fortune 500 to basically obliterated out of the market because of the technology that came along. So there's lots of examples like that, when we just need to sometimes know when to change, when to self-disrupt. I mean, you know, sometimes it's just amazing that sometimes we just need to know when enough is enough. And that's also a sign of resilience, even though from the outside it can look like failure. And I'm, you know, obviously anyone's gone through a divorce. You know, there are divorces that happen to you, and then sometimes divorces that you do, or breaking up in any relationship for that matter. And, you know, I think, you know, often even in my work with families and stuff, you know, sometimes you say that this is really, you can save this, but do you want to? Like, is it really worth it? I mean, it's never going to really be great. It's going to be sustainable, but it's not going to be great. And then sometimes when people are still, you know, maybe young enough, or, you know, they have the resources to do it, the advice might be that, you know, failure at this marriage or this relationship is actually a better strategy right now to move on. And that's a resilient strategy, because it allows you then to access the next, to be open to what's about to happen and come up in the future, which can be really wonderful for you. So I think sometimes we misunderstand resilience as endless persistence of never letting go, of tenacity. And while those are good traits in many cases, there's also cases where letting go would be better. And that, you know, just acknowledging that maybe this is a bad fit where we are, and this relationship isn't working, or whatever, or this career, this town isn't working. And that resilience to know when to let go and to admit defeat and to move on is a really good skill set, and ultimately sets us up for future success.
How does one have that skill? Does it come from self-awareness, or is there more to it? How do they know when to accept defeat, or either way it's resilience, but, or keep going?
Well, like any sort of strategic withdrawal, even in conflict situations, I think you're partly, it's self-awareness. It's also experience. Sometimes it's willingness to listen to friends and others who are telling us or giving us clues that this is not really the best place for you. But often it is, unfortunately, a cognitive strategy that starts with us being brave enough to question that and say, yeah, this is the time for a change. I think that usually the cue is there. We're uncomfortable. We're psychosomatically, we're not sleeping, we're not eating, we're overeating, we're disrupted, or we're oversleeping, we're dysregulated in some respects. And often those are clues that something isn't quite right in is where we are. Now, I'm assuming the person has the power to leave. If you're in an abusive relationship, please don't heed this advice. You could put yourself in a very dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm.
Same way as, you know, financially, you might not be able to divorce. It'd be a tremendous drain on your, but you're starting a new business and suddenly you're going through a divorce and now you're bankrupt or something. So there's a reasonableness to this, what I'm saying. But when you have the opportunities to move on, retrain, reboot, this is not necessarily a bad resilience strategy for that sort of strategic, you know, rolling back and then starting again. I think entrepreneurs are really good at that. They'll know that, you know, it's time to declare bankruptcy and move on to the next big idea. People who invent things are really good at that too. They, you know, they know when this experiment is going nowhere and it's a failure, and they'll, you know, move on to the next idea. You know, if you, you know, I like watching those shows, those Dragon Dens, or as you know, Shark Tank in the US, Dragon Den in Canada. There's variations on it when entrepreneurs pitch ideas. And the entrepreneurs who are going to, you know, make the money, are going to give them money, are often like, you've done this for how many years and you still have that idea, you know? And, you know, yeah, sure, there's always that one case in 100 that, you know, they show them 5 years later. Look at me. Great success. I never took your advice, which is great. But the other 99 did go home and wasted more money.
Right.
So sometimes, I mean, you know, you still have, you know, if you're happy with pursuing this, then you keep going. Keep going. Enjoy it. Why not? Who cares? You're in it. You love it. And more power to you. I won't judge.
Right.
But if you're not happy, then maybe that's a clue to begin to think about option B, you know, option B, like the second choices, or maybe third or fifth choices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you know, when you look at people who are resilient, who show resilience, who these patterns appear in their lives, they know when to self-disrupt, or they have experiences of self-disruption that have often led them into something better, or at least gotten them out of a bad situation.
Yeah. And I'll relate this to my experience as well. And this is such great advice because it relates to like so much. Like, it's not just personal, like it's not just academic or professional. It can relate to personal situations. In my case, I think it was until now, I didn't realize, like, the way you framed it, that resilience is also just about letting go sometimes. And for me, I felt this immense pressure when I realized I don't want to write the MCAT anymore again. I don't want to pursue medical school. I knew I felt that almost as soon as I even felt that even before I got rejection from medical school. I felt that I don't even know if this is something that's for me. But after I didn't get, like, after I decided and I told my parents, I told my friends, so many of them, but you worked so hard for this. Why are you giving up? Like, come on, look, like I've heard of people who applied so many times and they got in. I'm like, and I heard all these stories and I'm like, I hear you. But, and I remember after all these conversations, I was in my car after that and I was crying, like, what am I doing? Am I doing something wrong? Like, my heart tells me one thing. My friends and my family are telling me another thing. Right now, everyone's kind of already adjusted to the fact that I'm not going to medicine. But in the first few months when that just happened, it hit me hard. And I think journaling, well, for me personally, journaling helped me get through that, because journaling is when I was almost interrogating myself at some points. Where it's like, do I want to go? Do I want to do this again? Everyone's telling me to go. It's logical to probably go because you put so many years of your life into this. But then I started writing to myself, like, almost angrily at myself. It's like, obviously you don't want to do this. Just let go. And I think eventually I started letting go of that. But it felt like a very jarring experience. And now that you're saying all of this, it's all making sense now. I had to have a certain amount of determination to kind of go through with what I wanted to, what felt right at the moment, other than that, like the pressure that was from the outside. And some people were supporting me in my decision, but others were not understanding, why am I just, after one time of not getting accepted, why am I not flying again? I think I made the right decision. And hearing you say these things about resilience, just now I'm even more sure that I made the right decision. I have another question for you. It seems like we do have the time. So one of your books titled Multisystemic Resilience, and you've touched on this briefly already, it integrates different knowledge systems. It's including research that taps into local knowledge, indigenous ways of knowing, as well as some Western science. How can this interdisciplinary approach be used to help people from diverse backgrounds navigate rejection and other personal or professional setbacks? What did you learn from by really combining all of this knowledge that maybe you wouldn't otherwise have learned in your other works that you've done before that?
Great question. What I'm finding is, if once you enter the space of more thinking about systems and multiple systems, mm-hmm. you know, colliding and creating the conditions for our experience of resilience, then you kind of open yourself to different ways of understanding the world. So what's success mm-hmm. or failure in one context? You know, I've traveled to, I think, to over 80 countries in the world. I've, you know, I travel a lot. I have colleagues all over the globe. And I think the humility that that brings to say there is no one right way of doing things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a consequence of that, you're also, I think, saying to, you know, what failure means and how people think about it. Is it, you know, is it a spiritual thing? Am I ill-fated because of something I've done and I need to exercise something out of me? Is it a spiritual problem that I'm experiencing versus a capacity problem, which I might think about in my world space, but other people might think of it as something very different? Other people are very fatalistic based on their ancestors or their karma or otherwise, different concepts around the world appear. So failure can be renamed many things, depending on your religious views, your spiritual views, your cultural views. And, you know, to just assume that failure means something always the same to me in my space doesn't, I've learned that that's not always the case. I mean, we've had this conversation because we are, you know, we're occupying a certain relatively similar cultural space, you know, mm-hmm. that you and I are occupying. But if this was on a global scale, and we had people from 80 different countries, then this conversation about both resilience, but also about failure and embracing failure might take on a more spiritual tone or a more cultural tone or more, you know, something about our ancestors or something about the cosmos, something about nature. Mm-hmm. That might be more of a historic lessons brought in. You know, we might think in terms of seven generations, in terms of just myself and my parents. So all of those things would change how we approach which systems we are going to bring in, which cultural systems, which family systems, which social systems, which cosmos, which ecological systems we're going to engage with and think about, are all going to contribute to our personal, very personal experience and the meaning we attribute to failure. So I often encourage people to think, remind yourself, what does this mean inside your family? And let's face it, for many newcomers, their first generation, it's been a common thread that, you know, where the child is expected to reach a certain level of success. And that often means certain professionalism. That's not always great doesn't always serve the child, but it's embedded in that particular cultural space. And that's because the family system and the historic system and the history and you sitting down, looking in the mirror and saying, oh, I'm a failure or I'm a success or what that exactly means. It's like, literally there are other people standing behind you in that mirror. There are other cultures lined up around you. You are bubble wrapped inside other systems. Even the financial systems, even what, you know, the economic, social, political systems. And, you know, if you're in a war, you don't necessarily, we're working, I have a big project right now with Ukrainian newcomers to Canada who are in Canada under a temporary visa program, and their understanding, young people's understandings of those experiences. And you know, you just, you know, you think about school performance in a very different way if you're working in your third or fourth language and you've just come out of a traumatic past. So you, all of these systems, all these different experiences collide to define our experience of failure and what it means to, in a sense, come through that and be more resilient. And so I do think sometimes we just forget that. We present it all as if it's going to be the same for everybody. Maybe for your, you know, you should interview somebody from a culture that's very spirit-driven to think what might failure mean from an Indigenous perspective, what it might mean from a Hindu perspective. I just made that one. I don't know if there's any difference at all. I don't know much about the Hindu failure. A Muslim, based on Islamic texts, based on Judaic texts, whatever. You know, I'd kind of romp around the world, talk to a Buddhist. They might have a very different perspective on what this all means, or indeed, and they, even that's implying the similarity. A Buddhist from Nepal and a Buddhist from, you know, Thailand might have a very, very different story to tell, depending on what branch of Buddhism they adhere to. So, you know, again and again and again, I guess I look at all this complexity and celebrate it as opposed to challenge it, because I think what it does is it explains why people get through very difficult situations.
Yeah, thank you for the ideas. I should definitely look at different cultures' perspectives and how they define failure, what the rejection meant for them. We are soon nearing to the end, and I just have two questions for you. The first one, what would you say are the key takeaways for our listeners on building resilience and handling rejection? And then the other one is about how do people connect with you, learn more about your work?
So I think the key takeaway here is just think about, you know, when you're experiencing rejection or failure, I think one, it's a, it should be a learning experience. And two, that, you know, your success is likely to depend on far more than just your own individual positive thinking. And that actually maybe positive thinking is a trap that sometimes blinds us to the time that we need to change. So I'm really about, you know, our individual rugged qualities, meeting the resources around us to make us our best selves. And, you know, and finding a space to explore that. And sometimes failure just points us in a new direction where we can be even a better self than we would.
And where can the people connect with you and learn more about your work if they wanted to?
Sure. Well, they can always find me online at my website. Yeah, they can always find me at michaelungar.com. It's easy to find there. I have a research website too that some folks might be interested in, which is resilience research, all one word, .org, O-R-G. So that's we get lots and lots of traffic across that platform. And then my books and YouTube channel and all that kind of other stuff. You just type in Michael and Ungar. That's U-N-G-A-R. Often people misspell it. yeah, then, you know, a lot of these materials are open source. A lot of stuff and a lot of the books are there. But it's really, you know, for me, it's been a voyage of trying to share these ideas as much as possible to shift the conversation of resilience into a more, you know, ecological, sensitive, environmentally sensitive idea. And I appreciate very, very much, Valeria, this opportunity to share some of these ideas, especially around this fun theme of and I say that fun of knowing, you know, sometimes rejection is necessary for growth.
It definitely is. I attest to that. But yeah, thank you so much, Michael, for joining me on the podcast today. It's been an incredible privilege to dive into your expertise on the important but often undiscussed themes of rejection and resilience. And as Michael has shared, rejection isn't just about bouncing back, but it also lies in our ability to self-disrupt and embrace occasional but much needed failure. By understanding how we can reframe challenges, we open ourselves to new opportunities, like you were saying, and paths that may have once maybe even seemed out of reach. So I encourage everyone to reflect on the practical tools Michael has shared today and remember that our struggles don't define us. They're merely stepping stones towards greater strength and personal or even professional growth. Resilience is not just a trait we're born with. It is a skill we can all develop. Listeners, I'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode. What resonated most with you and how do you cultivate resilience in your own life? Feel free to reach out on social media or suggest topics for future episodes. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can donate at buymeacoffee.com/Valeria Rusnak. The link will be for that in the show notes, and also for Michael's social media and all the website, and all of that will also be in the show notes. This has been Valeria Rusnak, the host of the Rejected Pre-Med podcast. I thank you for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.